So number one, we have to fight. But number two is what Alice Walker said, and I'm paraphrasing her here. What she said was, the biggest way people give up power is by not knowing we have it to start with.
Good evening. This is Sherry Morish. I am interviewing presidential candidate Dr. Jill Stein. Dr. Stein, thank you for having this interview with me and coming to KBOO.
Thank you so much. No, it's really great to be here and in support of, you know, independent radio, which we need so much, independent media. This is where the real action is. So it's great to be here.
I hope you are enjoying your stay in Portland, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate your being here.
Thank you so much.
So what was a pivotal moment that shifted your career from being a medical doctor to a full-time political activist and eventually running for president?
It happened actually over a series of years. And I think one thing that really boosted my commitment to political activism happened in 2002, actually, when the Democratic Party in my home state of Massachusetts decided that they were going to repeal the campaign finance reform that we the people had just passed as a referendum. We passed the so-called Clean Elections Law that, to my mind, got to the heart of the problem, got the money and the corruption out of politics and created a independent pathway whereby candidates could run for office and not have to go on bended knee to the powers that be. And the state legislature had refused to pass it. We finally put it to the voters as a referendum and passed it by a 2-to-1 majority. Huge support. And then the Democrats turned around and repealed it on a voice vote in the legislature. And to me, at that point, I had been fighting, you know, really as a public health advocate, as a medical doctor who realized that health care is not really made inside the office. By the time people come to the office with problems, you're well along the way. You really have to address them up front. And, you know, it's sort of at the level of community-based causes of illness, whether it's pollution or poverty or community violence, poor nutrition, et cetera, you have to address the systemic drivers. And so I had been a very discouraged activist, seeing that you really can't move policy. You can't.
Right.
Not if it's meaningful policy. And so then I became involved in the clean elections fight in my home state, and we were victorious.
Yes.
And it was wonderful. And then the Democrats repealed it. And at that point, I just realized, okay, I really have to fight this at the level of being an independent candidate. And at that point, I became really kind of a confirmed Green Party activist.
Wow.
And at that point, I had just started running and was not yet running at the level of a national campaign, but I was running for governor of Massachusetts.
Wow.
And I was already in that campaign, but at that point, it was clear to me that this really needed a fight. A very committed fight. And as the years went on, I realized that you can't do that fight and have your feet in two worlds, that medicine is too time intensive and politics is equally time intensive. You can't do both. So eventually I learned that I couldn't do both. And I felt like what I was doing in medicine is fairly constrained and you're kind of following formulas and you know, and it felt like I was replaceable in medicine.
Oh.
But, you know, and that's very important work. And, you know, I love to follow it and greatly appreciate the providers who do that work. But I also realized that it was only kind of circumstantial. It was having worked with many movements that I could bring a team to bear to the political fight. And you can't just hand that off to someone.
Right.
So when I realized I was going to have to make a choice between the two, I felt like I can't not fight the political fight because everything that I was fighting for healthcare or, you know, climate, you know, to change our foreign policy so it's not just, you know, one war after another. You know, an exercise of brute force is really what our foreign policy is about. You know, I realized exactly. If any of that matters, I have to stay in this fight. And I just became very convinced, really through my work in environmental health, I just became really convinced that we're going down with the ship here unless we have a really, fundamental system reboot. So I began to see that struggle as my own struggle, the struggle of my family and my community and the people near me. Are we going to have lives, you know, to look forward to? And I feel like time has only borne that out.
Right.
You know, this fight just gets more critical by the day. So that's why I decided to keep doing this.
Fascinating. And actually, I am going to skip down a few questions because I have a question where campaign finance reform is concerned, and it's more than what we have written here. Mm. Campaign finance reform, in my view, is the foundation of everything that we need to improve in this nation. Getting campaign finance reform nailed down will allow us to elect people like yourself who authentically care about our communities and want to work for the people. That's why we live in a representative democracy. So we're here in Oregon, we have IP9 and IP42 battling it out, right? And we're the two petitions are trying to make it to the ballot in November. In the meantime, the legislature, in this 35-day short session, decided to initiate their own legislation called HB 4024, and they're trying to rush it through our state legislature.
Wow.
Your efforts in campaign finance reform and experiences with the clean election law in Massachusetts highlight significant challenges in our electrical system. As president, what specific reforms would you advocate for to ensure fairer elections and reduce the influence of money in politics? And I actually want to go deeper into that, but we have so much time, so let's stick with that.
Great. All right. And I will just try to stick with the highlights because we could talk all day. You know, in my view, we have a real crisis in our democracy, and we have never had really a real democracy, but we've had a promise, at least, of democracy. You know, we've had democracy for some, basically. And so many parts of that democracy have really been torn asunder now. So there was a time when we did have limits on money in politics. Now we really don't, not at all. And each election, you know, the numbers continue to go off the charts. I think in 2016, it was somewhere around, I think it was $6 or $7 billion that went into that election. In 2020, that more than doubled. It's coming in now, not in small numbers. It's coming in ever larger and larger numbers. And much of it we don't even know about or hear about. So it's not only super PACs and dark money, but you also have these sort of devious legal structures that the major parties use. One of them is called victory funds, whereby a single billionaire can write, or multimillionaire can write, a single check for $600,000 or more to either, you know, in the last election, to either Joe Biden or Donald Trump and their campaigns. And it basically enables single individuals to wield that kind of power that they're, you know, they have a make or break type contribution, and that invariably comes with strings attached, whether they're explicit or implicit. You know, it's just it's an inherently corrupt system, and that's the way it works. So that's one of the things we need to address, and because of the Supreme Court rulings right now, we have to consider money free speech, which is interesting because the Supreme Court and the rest of our system doesn't protect free speech at all. It's only when it's money that they protect free speech.
Yeah,
it's so ludicrous. We need, from what I understand, we need a constitutional amendment. That won't happen quickly, but we can at least create the alternative, which is a public financed system. So we can create that. That won't stop the billionaires from going hog wild and buying their candidates, but then at least there will be a competitor who could be who could be economically viable if we had public funding. So that's one thing we need. We also need free airtime. We need to reclaim the public airwaves to be used for the purpose of educating the public in elections. That would go a long way. Excuse me. And that would greatly reduce the cost of political campaigns if we actually had that. We need debates, which are not hosted by the Democratic and Republican parties themselves, who have been essentially
exactly.
the commission on debates, on presidential debates, which was run by the private corporations of those two parties. We need to go back to a League of Women Voters type situation where it's an independent authority that's hosting these, and we need to have inclusive debates, not just the two parties. We need ranked choice voting and proportional yes. representation so we can get beyond this two-party trap, which is essentially the political apologists and servants of the economic elite. So if you have a multi-party system, it's much harder to corrupt it. You have many options. And people don't feel like they are being extorted. They can't be fear campaigned. Right now, people can be fear campaigned, and I believe it's a false fear because third parties don't take votes away from other candidates. They mostly draw out of the bucket of people who aren't otherwise voting. So it's really a myth. Yes, and there's data.
Okay.
There's a lot of data to support that, particularly in our races where I know the data well. We drew from people who otherwise were going to stay home. So this whole myth that you're taking, that you as a third-party candidate are stealing votes from someone, that's baloney. And that is used to fear campaign voters and to tell them they can't vote for who they want. They have to vote for the so-called lesser evil. But I think the whole concept of lesser evil has really gone out the door when that lesser evil happens to be the main proponent of genocide right now. You know, how do you call that the lesser evil?
Okay,
and all that?
That's a conversation for another day, because while I agree with your statement itself, the 1948 legislation that made Israel a sovereign nation and us an ally to them kind of mandates the support for genocide, unfortunately. My problem is, why are they blocking ceasefires?
And let's separate that, because there's a bunch of questions there that should be discussed in and
yes.
of themselves. But just to complete, this question about what can we do to sort of revive our democracy, I want to at least make the point that ranked choice voting and proportional representation completely lay to rest this question of taking votes from someone else, because those voting systems don't allow a vote to be split at all. And I could go into the details on that if you wanted. But that's part.
Oh, definitely one. I don't know if we have time, because that's super interesting. I've never heard that before.
Are you familiar with ranked choice voting?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm so totally for ranked choice voting.
Right. And what it does, it assures the voter, among other things, that they can vote for an underdog, knowing that if the underdog doesn't win, their vote gets reassigned to their second choice. So you never have to worry about a vote getting split, because all those votes basically get converged.
I think we should have ranked choice voting at a national level.
Absolutely.
We're testing it out here in Portland.
So I understand.
I believe this November.
That
we're
is so exciting.
Yes. I'm super excited for
yeah.
it. Our entire city council is being expanded as well. So that's another super awesome improvement. So back to you.
Yeah.
and I agree, ranked choice voting is that should be a national thing.
And we could come back to the question about, Israel and what does 1948 legislation dictate, because, to my mind, it by no means dictates genocide. Nothing dictates genocide.
If you want to speak on that, please do, because I need understanding and clarity, because if you were sitting mm-hmm. in Biden's seat right now, you would be set with the same questions.
Well,
and
Biden
would have to make the
and
same
decisions. Let me just note that Biden has accepted like $5 million from AIPAC. So he's influenced, as a decision maker. it's important to understand, you know, the origins of the state of Israel too, you know, and the origins of Zionism. And let me say that the super Orthodox rabbis oppose Zionism as being anti-Jewish because it fundamentally violates basic Jewish tenets, including what they say, thou shalt not kill and thou shalt not steal. And Zionism, as currently, followed, relies on taking land that belonged to Palestinians. And that was authorized basically by a colonialist structure. Initially, the mandate from the British mandate on Palestine, and then from there, it was a United Nations decision. Mm-hmm. But that, and that's right, that was a United Nations decision. And the opponents of genocide are not saying that Israel has to give that land back. Rather, what they're saying is that that land needs to be governed in a way that's consistent with international law. And you can't occupy the other parts of Palestine.
Right.
So nobody's saying Israel get lost. Although there are questions about what, you know, how these two countries can best comply with international law, whether the two-state solution can do it or whether it needs to be a one-state solution. And there's a strong argument that the two-state solution just doesn't work. But
Why is that? Because I would think a two-state solution is exactly what's needed. The Palestinian people deserve their land. That is their land. And then I've heard, you are Jewish, right?
Yes.
And I found out recently I'm part Jewish.
Okay.
So that opened up a whole new world. But what I heard some Jewish people argue is that Israel has been at the target of other nations because of the Jewish community within Israel, and that they deserve the Palestinian land. And I don't agree.
Right.
The Palestinians had their land. And Israel, you'll excuse my ignorance here, but Israel was not always a nation.
That's right.
On its own.
It never was until, well,
after World War II, it became a
nation. After 1948.
Yes.
Yes, after a UN decision. Israel was basically created at that point after there had been a big movement fostered by Zionism. And Zionism, you know, in part was a reaction to the persecution of Jews. And, you know, my own family came to the U.S. fleeing pogroms. And my grandparents were going to be conscripted into the Russian army at age 6, you know. Wow. So that's why they fled. And, you know, that was the experience of European Jews. You know, so it's absolutely understandable. You know, Jews very much rely, you know, have experienced anti-Semitism, vicious, horrible, and, you know, and the Holocaust was the ultimate expression of that. But
yes,
even before the Holocaust, there were other, you know, really horrible, occasions, frequent, you know, just persecution of Jews all over Europe. It was really a terrible thing. That, however, does not give you a right to then go and take somebody else's
exactly.
land.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I've argued that very point.
Yes.
They don't. The Palestinians didn't do anything.
Right. Right.
If Hamas did.
You give them your land if you would like.
Exactly.
You know, give them your land. Yes. And so,
how would you, if you were in Biden's shoes, you know,
I would comply with international law is what I would do. And
so
I would stop blocking UN resolutions.
How is he not complying with it?
Oh, because for decades, actually, the UN has been on record. You know, in 1967, there was a war where Israel basically conquered the West Bank and Gaza and the Sinai Peninsula, et cetera, and basically took that land. And so following 1967, the UN, I think just about every year the UN says, and this is like pretty much unanimously, except for the U.S. and Israel, the UN has an enormous vote that occupation is not legal. this is not a legal occupation of either Gaza or the West Bank or the other areas, that land has to be returned, that it's not okay to conquer somebody else's territory and then just appropriate it and build settlements on it and so on. But
So that's the whole thing. I mean,
that is
the whole thing. It's always been such a complicated thing that I'll hear about it and I'll hear the stories and I'll watch the news and we get American media, right?
Oh, yeah.
But even reading like Al Jazeera and other publications, we're still getting censored American media. And so it's always been a really confusing issue. And I feel bad for not making a statement on one side or the other because I honestly don't have enough information.
It's a little bit to come to terms with. And one source that I have found very useful is Jewish Voice for Peace. They actually talk about the history of the problem and the history of Zionism and all that. And I found, there are so many critical dates in this story. I found it just very helpful to get a handle on what are those critical dates and what happened when.
Because it's going to continue to become most important as the people die and as Netanyahu continues to slaughter people.
Oh,
that's ridiculous. Yes. I'm sorry.
And it is, to my mind, it is kind of, as horrible as the situation is, it's uplifting to see this kind of surge of humanity saying, this is not okay to be killing women and children. Whatever came before, you can't then go ahead and multiply whatever injustice you feel like has been done to you. You can't then do it to someone else.
Exactly.
And so it's not okay. Watching children and women be slaughtered is extremely painful.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, in the beginning, on October 7th, I believe it was, when Hamas attacked Israel, you would expect a retaliation of some sort. Not that it's good or bad or anything. It's just expected. But to continue on,
it's very problematic. But it's important to remember that the conflict did not begin on October 7th. In the same way it's natural for Israel to respond, it was also natural for Hamas to respond to decades of slaughter, actually, from the Israeli army. So, in my mind, it's never okay to kill innocent civilians. It's never okay to do that. On the other hand, if you are occupying and committing the daily atrocities of apartheid, you're going to expect to see that. And, Israelis consider, or I should say Netanyahu considers Hamas a terrorist organization now, like they did the PLO beforehand. There's always going to be an organization of resistance. You cannot fix this problem by simply trying to slaughter Hamas.
But didn't Hamas overtake the Palestinian government and that's how they became?
Well, they were elected. They were elected. They were democratically elected in elections that George Bush insisted happened. So they got elected into power in 2008.
I would argue that from the 90s because they attacked.
Well, see, I mean, the whole situation is I don't know. I mean, my understanding, Hamas did. They did not gain power until 2008 when they were elected.
Okay.
And one of the drivers for Hamas was actually the Israeli government, which was funding Hamas in order to compete with the power of the PLO. So there's just been treachery here.
That's crazy.
All along. Oh. And, how do you ever get to the bottom of it? Well, Jews there have always been Jews in Palestine. And the Jews and the Israelis, I'm sorry, The Jews and the Palestinians actually got along very well. They got along very well. It was only when the Zionists came in that trouble started. And in fact, many of the Orthodox Jews left when the Zionists came in.
I do remember hearing that. Yeah. I do remember hearing that.
Yeah,
I'm not even sure we should be, as Americans, involved in that whole situation. But we should not be advocating on the side of genocide.
Absolutely. And we're providing the weapons for genocide, and we are providing, the diplomatic cover. The rest of the world is united that this has to stop. In fact, there's the beginnings now of a boycott by the nations of the world against Israel. And the UN has actually called for this now.
Yeah.
So, it's tragic because not only are Palestinians being slaughtered, but this puts the Israelis at grave risk too, because they've made themselves a pariah among nations. So it puts Israelis at risk. It puts the entire Middle East at risk, because Joe Biden is doing what he knows how to do, which is make war and expand war. So he's now bombing Syria and Iraq and
Are we
Yemen.
The United States bombing Syria? Well, yes. I know we were,
yes,
because
we
were
ourselves.
Attacked by
That's right.
we were attacked by the Houthis. Which is why
going
there.
What the Houthis were doing, and this is important as well, the Houthis, or Ansar Allah, as they prefer to call themselves,
okay.
what they did was step up to the United Nations treaty against genocide, which says that that nations are obliged to do what they can do to stop genocide. So what the Houthis did, and what they continue to do, is stop the delivery of weapons and support to
That's
Israel.
That's what they were
to
see, because in
That's
American
what
media, what
we, don't
we
talk about
hear
that. Yep.
is the Houthis are attacking our Navy ships and merchant ships. And we're like, no, you are not attacking our military people. That's what we hear.
That's what we're told to think. Yes, exactly. But the Houthis have been very clear about this all along. That they are so they don't attack. They don't attack any ship unless it's delivering goods to Israel.
Oh, that's crazy. Okay.
It is very crazy. So we could stop this conflict immediately by simply obeying national law, simply by obeying U.S. law, which also forbids us from providing money and weapons and military support to nations that are committing war crimes,
which
Israel
is
doing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow. You just trained me because I mean I stay aware
yes.
as much as I can, but
it's
you obviously
yeah.
have access to a lot more resources than I do in my daily marketing stuff.
So unless you are a full-time news geek on this, you know, it's impossible to stay up with it, you know,
right.
and to resist the propaganda that wants you to think otherwise.
Right. Right, exactly. Well, KBOO, we get Democracy yeah. Now, and we get
okay.
a lot of
yeah.
other news outlets. Pacifica,
great.
Pacifica is a fabulous resource. However, you only hear it on public access radio. In fact, I believe you can listen to them online.
Cool.
So, moving on, yours is truly. I'm going to. Yours is truly a grassroots campaign. What are you finding as you travel across the country? What commonalities and differences are you finding across regions and states?
It is really amazing that people are really laboring under the same sense of crisis right now. This is, I guess, my overwhelming impression, is that it doesn't matter where you are. People are really struggling to keep their heads above water right now. Things have gotten so extreme that, you know, it's like 50% of people who rent right now are severely economically stressed. They're paying more than 30% of their income just to keep a roof over their head. So then how do you pay for your food and your, mm-hmm. you know, and your heat and you know, just your student loans and everything else, you know, and then there's student loans, which
yep.
also didn't get better. And, you know, no thanks to Joe Biden, who created these extreme loans and prevented people from having a way out, and who reinstituted the payments for those loans when they didn't need to be, you know, restarted. You know, the healthcare crisis that 100 million Americans, you know, now are strapped with medical debt. And so many people are choosing between their medicines or their rent. And, you know, the Democrats are patting themselves on the back saying, oh, well, we, you know, we passed this great cost reduction bill for pharmaceuticals. But the reality is that's only going to be 10 pharmaceuticals out of thousands.
Right.
Costs will be reduced only for 10, and that won't even happen until 2026. You know, so it's nonsense. And the climate is going up in flames right now. And
right.
the Colorado River, which feeds the California agriculture system, which feeds the whole nation
yeah,
for
cool.
our fruits and that's going. It's mm-hmm. only, you know, it's a matter of maybe months or years at most. So, you know, the Washington Post ran a headline like last year that said something like, they called it like something akin to the worst case, the doomsday scenario. They called it the doomsday scenario that was rolling out in the Colorado River. So people are just so mindful right now. And the crushing economy, the endless wars that are draining our national resources and creating havoc the world over, and the climate catastrophe really dominate people's mindset. So that's what I'm seeing. You know, every conversation just really quickly goes into the sense of crisis that people have right now.
As president, how would you address some of these?
Oh, there are solutions that are waiting to be put to work. For example, an improved Medicare for All system. You know, expand Medicare so that it covers those things that are currently uncovered, like your eyeglasses or your hearing aids or your mental health or your chronic care. And you expand the age spectrum from the moment of conception, basically, until you are laid to your rest. And that doesn't cost us. That actually saves us money simply by removing the predatory middleman of the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical profiteering. We save $500 billion a year. So why do we not have this already when it would save money and improve our health and quality of life? You know, we don't have it because we have a corrupt political system that serves its big donors. That's why we don't have it. And the Democrats talk about it. But when they actually come to power, as they did, for example, in California, and I believe they did also in Washington State. I mean, so many states have had the opportunity to actually implement this stuff, and they don't do it. They will find one reason or another not to do it because they are servants of an economic elite. So that's one thing that we could do, one solution that needs to be implemented. And there's so much public support for it that we could drive it through. We could, you know, basically work with the broad grassroots movements and drive it forward by holding congressmen and women accountable, by holding town hall meetings, and really by forcing their hand, which is what you will have to do, in order to pass a people's agenda until we complete the revolution and get Greens and other independent socialist type candidates elected at all levels of government, which is also what we need to do. But I believe we can jumpstart this process, and we're in a really powerful, perfect storm, really, for political transition right now. And one of those perfect storms is what I mentioned earlier when we were talking, in that the dynamics of this election are very favorable to a political uprising and a peaceful revolution. Here's one of those ways. First of all, people are chomping at the bit. They're tired of being thrown under the bus, and to look at any polls whatsoever, you know, people have had it with the parties of war on Wall Street. They're done with that. And then it's the highest record ever in terms of that sort of polling. So you have people who are really primed right now. They're really ready to make a change. In this election, there are going to be four corporate candidates on the ballot. So there will be, you know, Biden and Trump or their equivalents if they are replaced, because that's what the party's about right now. No labels will probably be on the ballot. They are an AstroTurf pretense of a party. They're not really a party. They're just a front group for billionaires and people with deep pockets. And their selling point, they think, is that they represent where we come together, you know, in corporate America, you know, the agreement between the Democratic and Republican parties, which is as bad as you could get. And then you have RFK, who at the end of the day is not changing things and is a pro-war candidate, accepting very big money, his super PAC, which would do the work to get him on the ballot. Half the money from that $50 million super PAC is coming from two people. So this is another big money campaign. And big money is just inherently corrupting. And what he says is, you know, oh, I will change the system. Don't look at what I do. Just look at what I say. You know, that's not terribly convincing. So anyhow, there will be those four entities. And all of them are pro-war, really neutral to negative on climate, and neutral to negative on workers' rights. So they are not, you know, they are not going to change what really ails us. But there will be four of them, and potentially they could be splitting the corporate vote four ways. In the coming election, to prevail, our pro-worker, anti-war, climate emergency campaign doesn't need actually to win a majority. What we need to do is win a plurality. That means be the biggest chunk. So if you had a vote split five ways, that's 20%.
Right.
So potentially with 21%, it could be won. Now, it's probably not going to be exactly like that, but it does make the point that we don't necessarily have to have 51% of voters. It could sort out in such a way that the election is won with much less. There are other complexities to the Electoral College, but essentially it would follow in suit.
So I have a basic civics question for you. As president, you would need to work with both the Senate and the House in passing legislation, right? Or even getting the ball rolling on legislation. I'm curious as to why you believe being president would offer you more power or more influence than being a member of Congress.
Yeah, and you know, I did not plan to run for president. And I was one of the people who helped recruit Cornel West to be the candidate. And then, you know, we decided to part ways amicably because he had never run for office before, had never run with a political party. And it's a lot to come to terms with in one election. It's challenging to work with a political party if you're not already part of that culture and that dynamic. And that proved, I think, to be an added stress. It's stressful enough to run for president. But he's been a powerful solo voice throughout his career. Mm-hmm. And when you're part of a party, you have to answer to people who are working for you, so they expect to be able to dialogue with you about a lot of stuff. So I think that was not easy for him. So I totally understand why he wanted to go his own way. But then that left us without a candidate. We have worked our way to a certain kind of political empowerment through having ballot status. You have to fight for that. You have to work for it, unless you're a Democrat and a Republican, and then you're basically grandfathered in. But otherwise, you have to really fight for that ballot status. And if we didn't have a candidate, we would lose it. So I was strong-armed on many sides to step up because I'd run twice before. Yeah. And so it's not such a big deal to, you know, to do that. If you haven't done this before, it would be really hard to do that. And we had deadlines that we had to meet if we were going to qualify to be on the ballot in California. And if we didn't meet those deadlines, then it would cost us millions of dollars just to get on the ballot in California alone. So decisions had to be made, and all that had to happen quickly. So by hook or by crook, that's how I wound up running for president. I was actually very interested in running for Congress this time around.
Because your ideas are vibrant.
Thank you.
And you're motivated. And you could bring a lot of us along with you.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, if you're in a congressional district, you can't do much with that. You don't really have the capacity to organize in a bigger way. On the other hand, if you're sitting in the White House, you have a huge bully pulpit. And you can mobilize those same ground troops and more and basically conduct ground organizing campaigns, which is what would need to be done if you're not walking into a full house of, you know, whether it's Congress or the House of Representatives. You don't have, and we would have some, we have some great candidates running. Our campaign manager, for example, is also a congressional candidate in Washington State.
Wow, that's
Jason
wonderful.
Call, who is amazing. He's wonderful. People should check him out. Jason Call, who's fabulous. And he's one of, you know, a number of very strong candidates who basically, you know, came from various places, but many of them got sick and tired of being part of the Sanders campaign and watching it basically get sabotaged.
Yeah.
So we had people coming in who've had a lot of experience. They've been running the progressive wing, the truly progressive wing of the Democratic Party, and being true to their values, they said enough is enough. We're moving on. So, you know, we have some of that energy coming in, and we would have some very strong players in Congress, is my hope. We would not get to the White House without having a really strong grassroots movement built on the anti-genocide fight and the peace movement, built on the student debt fight, built on the Medicare for All fight. There are built on, you know, the immigrant rights fight. There are many of these groups that have had it now with the Democratic Party. They're organized and they're informed and they're motivated. All we have to do is get the ball rolling and let it then take on a life of its own, because as people begin to see others rising up, courage is contagious, and we could see those numbers begin to add up right away. So my sense is if we develop the grassroots movement to get into the White House, we will have the grassroots movement to keep going inside of the White House. Every piece of legislation will be a major undertaking, but we could actually get something done. Because right now, Congress doesn't pass anything anyhow, except, you know, more money for war, basically, is what they do. And then they do Wall Street bailouts. And then they do tax breaks for rich people. That's kind of all the Congress does these days. So, you know, there's nowhere to go but up.
Would you encourage people at the more local levels to be part of the Green Party and get into, like, their school boards or local city government? How would we encourage more activism in that regard?
Absolutely. And, in fact, you know, the Greens have elected about 1,000 local officials over the last 15 years or so. Yeah. And in the most recent election, I think there were 128 nationally who were either elected or reelected. And they actually get elected in fairly strong numbers, so that, you know, the odds of making that election have been very good. It's not like it's a remote possibility. It has gone very well. So, yes, this is exactly the strategy. And, you know, there is a very strong resistance from politics as we know it and mainstream media not to cover Greens because we are a threat. You know, there are other political parties that are not so much of a threat because they're still kind of, you know, more corporate power and it doesn't matter so much. But the Greens are really serious, and we have introduced most of the progressive ideas that have come forward in the last two decades, starting with Medicare for All and single payer that was introduced by Ralph Nader in 2000. Student debt bailout, you know, that was introduced by our campaign in 2012, and it was ridiculed. And then free public higher education, likewise, we did that in 2012. A lot of this stuff, you know, Sanders then echoed, as we did as well in 2016. And then this became, you know, the Green New Deal, we started that as well. The Democrats will give lip service to it, but they won't actually do anything about it. Yeah, so, Yeah.
That's sad. So I don't want to take up a whole lot of your time. Let's pick out one more question here. We did speak on foreign policy.
Yes.
Some. There's one that I really kind of wanted you to evaluate. The Green Party emphasizes grassroots democracy. Can you elaborate on how you plan to revitalize democracy and increase citizen participation in the political process?
I think it's so important, as we discussed earlier, to get the big money out, because it really makes people extremely cynical and hopeless about government. And, you know, government is kind of at an all-time low, at least in the modern era, in terms of faith and confidence in government. It's like down in the, you know, I think congressional approval is
13%.
That sounds about right. Yeah, mm-hmm. It aligns pretty well with mainstream media, you know, which has also been corporatized and hijacked. They all have been. Yeah, and so kind of we have a society that's really not functioning as a society right now, and we have to restore that faith, and we have to do it by cleaning house. And, you know, we come to this having adhered to those principles to start with, so, you know, we come with some credibility And this would be really important to push that kind of legislation forward as quickly as possible so that people feel like what they see is real. Because right now they don't. And it's true. You know, they're mostly looking at corporate cutouts, you know, at people who are taking their marching orders from special interests and corporations. It's really not a government.
But wouldn't we have to, take everybody out and flip them with somebody else?
That's definitely where we want to go. But I don't feel like, you know, right now when people look out onto the political landscape, they don't see any signs of integrity or honesty. They don't. I mean, name one.
AOC. You know. But I like her. And Katie Porter. You know, they don't take corporate PAC money.
Well, I'm not, I don't know, to tell you the truth.
Well, that's what they say.
Uh-huh. Well, that's only part of the game. Because when you're in the Democratic Party, you also get a lot of money from the leadership. You get money from leadership.
True.
Yeah. DNC. And leadership sure gets their money from it. And, you know, and AOC has been criticized because a lot of money that she raised was then given over to conservative Democrats.
Oh, I hadn't heard about that.
Yeah.
Oh.
If you Google
that.
I need
to go work on some more information.
And she's been criticized for failing to use the power that she had, not standing up and, you know, doing something with her votes, and likewise for the squad.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, what is the squad doing about genocide? It's really just Rashida Tlaib that's been standing up. And that's, to my mind, that is just, they disqualify themselves as progressives by looking the other way. And not only do they, like, not scream about it, but they're funding it. They're funding it.
But don't you think that during the Trump administration, when they were berated and beaten down, that that kind of like set the tone to what we're seeing now? With the MAGA right on in the same house, basically.
I see the MAGA right actually as a response to the abandonment of working people by the Democratic Party.
That's true. That I have heard that.
I mean, if you look at the most spoiled election ever, where the Democrats really got beat bad, there was no third party involved. It was following the Wall Street bailouts, you know, where Wall Street got bailed out and Main Street got thrown out. Yep. And people, you know, people really punished the Democrats. They lost 1,000 state rep seats.
Yep.
They lost 64 Congress seats. They lost 12 Senate seats, and they lost 13 governorships, you know.
Yep.
And they've only continued in that vein. That's where MAGA comes from.
That makes so much sense.
Working people are furious, you know, and people, it's not that people support Trump so much, it's just that they hate the Democrats.
Yeah.
And vice versa. And they're all corrupt. The Democrats and the Republicans are equally corrupt. Now, maybe the squad doesn't take corporate money, but they do take, well, I don't know. But there's lots of corrupt money coming into the Democratic Party that they are privy to. And they take marching orders from leadership.
They do.
That is a problem.
That is.
And they don't have to do that. So I think they have lost respect, among real progressives who are struggling.
I agree. And I thank you so much, Dr. Stein. I do not want to take up so much. Do you know we've been sitting here for hour?
Have we really?
But I've enjoyed talking with you so much. And this is
likewise,
a recording.
Sherry.
So I'm not sure, you know, what Ender will have in it
sure.
and what he won't.
Sure.
Is there anything else you would like to say?
Oh, just that I would really encourage people to go to JillStein2024.com because you can be a part of this. And this is a perfect storm for political transition. We are all in the crosshairs right now. Nobody is not. And, you know, I think the people who will defend the status quo, you know, are generally comfortable. You know, you may be in the upper 10 or 15%, and so you're not getting hit. But just about everybody else is right now and is terrified for our future and the climate and the explosion of war and genocide, the potential to, for those wars to go nuclear now. You know, and climate change that's just roaring ahead right now. We are not, you know, taking incremental steps to get out of this. We are only getting in deeper by the day. We really need transformative change. It's hard to say which candidate is the greater evil and which is the lesser evil now when it's the Democrats who are really leading the charge on war and genocide and attacking our civil liberties and the kind of censorship that's going on now and the blacklisting of young people who dare to speak out against genocide on campus.
So I've been hearing about that too.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. So I'd say, you know, seize the moment and, you know, declare your political independence and cast a vote on behalf of yourself and your family and your future and own this campaign. You know, there will be one anti-war, anti-genocide, climate action campaign that will be on the ballot across the country that will really be contesting with Empire. So go to our website and join the team. If you're in a position, throw some money into the hat. We can use it just to complete our ballot access struggles. But this is the moment. We need to seize this moment. We can't wait. This moment may not come again.
I wanted to vote for you in 2016. I ended up voting for Hillary because of the boogeyman thing, right? Mm-hmm. Today, people are saying, no, you have to vote for Biden. Otherwise, we'll get Trump. I would love to vote for you. What do I say to those people?
I think what you say to those people is that no one owns your vote. They have to earn your vote. What has Joe Biden done to earn your vote? You know, I think he's thrown working people under the bus. He did not pass the even the $15 minimum wage, did not go to bat on that. He destroyed the right to strike for the railroad workers and did huge disservice to working people, as did the Democrats in Congress, including the squad that abandoned those working people and forced a very dangerous contract on them from which
that
catastrophic spill occurred in East Palestine due to the very issues that the railroad workers were trying to address. You know, where did the public option go? On the environment, Joe Biden, you know, basically gave the thumbs up to these 22 liquid natural gas plants. Now, it's true they've been forced to put them on hold for the moment in the run-up to the election, but he shows absolutely no intention whatsoever to actually dismantle that plan, which is actually a consequence of blowing up the Nord Stream pipeline that enabled this whole new market to be opened up for fossil fuel export. And those plants, those LNG plants, are incredibly destructive. The Sierra Club just put out a report saying that they amount to 440 new coal plants. This reverses, with one stroke of the pen, this reverses all the progress that's been made in reducing fossil fuel production since 2005. This makes Trump look like an environmentalist. So I'd say, you know, same thing on immigration policies. So all the reasons that have been drummed into your head about why you need to, you know, vote for Biden and not Trump. I mean, you shouldn't vote for either of them. We shouldn't have to accept genocide or climate catastrophe or endless war that's verging on nuclear. We can have a good future, but we have to stand up and demand the way forward.
Awesome. Dr. Stein, thank you for your time, generous time in answering my plethora of questions. Go to JillStein.com.
It's JillStein2024.
JillStein2024.com and learn more about this fabulous, amazing lady.
Frederick Douglass said that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. Frederick Douglass, you know, who was fighting for the abolition of slavery. And it was true, you know, in the 1800s. It's no less true now. These crises we're facing are not going to solve themselves. We have to stand up and fight them. And we know how to do that, and we know what the solutions are. Consider that 68% of Americans already want a ceasefire, and half of Americans now do accept that this is genocide. You know, plus you got 44 million youth and older who are stuck in student debt, and 100 million who are saddled with medical debt. So there's enormous potential here to change course and to stand up and go to the polls and vote for a peaceful revolution that we desperately need and our future relies on. So I would just remind people, we do have the power, and it's up to us to stand up and use it.
Thank you for listening. This is Sherry with KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.